It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. When the Census Bureau counts people in prison, it doesn't always count them as residents of their home districts. Instead, it counts them as residents of the district where the prison is located, even though most states place voting restrictions on prisoners. Our guest unpacks the import of these laws and the consequences for democracy. Do you have a felony on your record? What was it like trying to vote after you completed your sentence? Was the process of re-registering to vote difficult or was it simple? Are you a lawyer or an advocate working on prison gerrymandering? What are your thoughts on this issue in Wisconsin? Do you think prisoners and people who have been convicted of felonies should have the right to vote? Or do you think that voting is a privilege? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. John Eason is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is the author of Big House on the Prairie, Rise of the Rural Ghetto and Prison Proliferation. John Eason, welcome to the Morning Show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So how does the census count people in prison?
So the census counts people where they are serving their time. These people are considered in group quarters. There are other types of populations that are in group quarters as well. Students, for example, are in group quarters, and so are some senior or assisted living homes can be considered group quarters. But in those cases, the individuals in those group quarters can elect to be counted or represented at another address if they so choose, and they also can vote. Prisoners, whereas prisoners cannot pick their elected officials, nor are they able to vote.
Well, how does this affect the way democracy works at state and local levels? Break that down for us.
So at the state level, well, at the national level, I should say, there are, according to the ACLU, there are over 5.3 million Americans who cannot vote. So that's taking huge numbers of people out of the voting pool. So that affects us nationally, but when you drill down into the state and local levels, it really affects the way that seats are apportioned across the state, representative seats. So if you have people, for example, in Wisconsin, if a disproportionate number of people are being arrested in, say, Milwaukee and being shipped to far-flung rural areas, because 70% of 70% of prisons are built in rural communities, then it affects the way that the state legislation draws its lines. It also affects the way that dollars flow. So monies are being taken away from places like Milwaukee and sent out to rural communities.
Is this practice legal?
Yes.
Who benefits?
Well, I study prison building primarily, but rural communities can really benefit from this, and rural legislators, because rural legislators in particular get to have a larger number of constituents without having to campaign or get their votes. So rural legislators can really get a big boost from populations being counted in their territories, so monetarily and politically.
So the people living in their district would have influence outsized from what it would actually be if the prisoners weren't counted.
Yes, yeah, sometimes preliminary studies have shown that this could be twice what would normally be expected. So there are some counties or some legislative districts in Wisconsin in particular that have twice the voting power that they would otherwise. The Prison Policy Initiative demonstrates this.
Do we know the scope of this problem?
It's massive. I think it's a fundamental, I think this country is more blue than what we, what our voting patterns show. Researchers demonstrated that in during the Bush-Gore election, that if felony disenfranchisement didn't occur at the rate that it did in Florida, that Gore would have won Florida in a landslide. So this has huge implications for our democracy.
Are people typically incarcerated in prisons outside of their home district?
Yes, they are. Often far-flung places. The funny thing is the rate of incarceration in rural areas is actually increasing over the last 20 to 30 years. But the really, I shouldn't use the word funny, I guess I've been looking at these numbers too long, but the even in those cases, the likelihood of being housed where you're from or near where you're from is not that high. This area needs a lot more research, however.
Does this also include federal prisons as well as state?
It's more so in the case of federal prisons. So only 5% of prisons are federal. So you're more likely to be moved to another state and or region. Part of your punishment could in fact be a regional transfer, depending on how you're serving time and the type of sentence that you have.
Okay, I guess that leads to the question, how do the demographics of the places where prisons tend to be located compare to the demographics of prisoners themselves?
So that is a very complicated question. So people think that prisoners are all from urban areas, as I just mentioned. Increasingly, prisoners are from rural communities as well. And there's a belief that, there's mainly inner city, so that means black and Latinx, prisoners are going out to white-only communities. And in fact, I've done a couple of analyses on this and looking at where prisoners are from versus the towns where the prisons go. And the counterintuitive thing is that as you increase the percent black and Latinx in a town, in a rural community, the probability of that town getting a prison increases. So this is very counterintuitive, but this is mainly a southern pattern. So towns in the south that have higher percentages of blacks and Latinx. This exists for the Midwest, but in places like Wisconsin, there are so few people of color in rural communities that it's a lot more complicated. You're going to have white people in these rural communities that are often corrections officers in the rural towns where I'm guessing the majority black and Latinx folks from inner cities are going in Wisconsin. I haven't done an analysis for this state in particular, but I do know that rural communities are increasingly incarcerating folks.
John Eason is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Are you currently incarcerated, or have you been incarcerated in the past? What have your experiences been with voting in Wisconsin? Do you think prisoners and people who have been convicted of felonies should have the right to vote? Let us know, 800-642-1234. Our conversation continues. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Where should prisoners be counted in the census, and why does it matter? That's what we're talking about with John Eason, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Do you have a felony on your record? What was it like trying to vote after you completed your sentence? Was the process of re-registering difficult, or was it simple? Are you a lawyer or an advocate working on prison gerrymandering? What are your thoughts on this issue in Wisconsin? Give us a call. Tell us your story. 800-642-1234. IT us at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Again, 800-642-1234. John Eason, how does prison gerrymandering affect actual political outcomes as it's reflected in elections and policies?
So I use the example in Florida, which I think is the most well-documented and studied case. My colleagues from the University of Minnesota and NYU, Chris Eugen and Jeff Manza, through a book called Locked Out, examine how prisoners, if formerly convicted persons, not those in prison right now, but formerly convicted, were given the right to vote, that basically for several elections, Florida would be, the U.S. presidency would have gone blue. And this goes all the way back, I believe, even before Bush v. Gore. But yeah, even before that landmark case was held, that, you know, we'd have a very different political system. So this has huge national implications. And I think in a state like Wisconsin, given the fact that this state, I just got here about 90 days ago, and this state has one of the highest disproportionate rates of incarceration. So that means that African Americans are incarcerated at a much higher rate than whites. And this is key, I think, in this state, because it's even more, it has a higher racial disparity in incarceration than where I just arrived from, which is Texas, which is saying quite a bit given Texas, the history of incarceration in Texas.
Let's take a phone call. Willie is with us from Steuben. Willie, good morning. Thanks for joining us on the morning show.
Hey, morning, John. I'm really thankful to live in Wisconsin. In 1991, I got busted growing marijuana, which will probably soon be legal here, too. But I've been a felon ever since, and after I got off probation, I was able to vote, and I have voted in every election, and I just want to know, or I want all of the people who might be felons to know that you can vote as long as you're not on probation or parole for a felony. Once you complete your sentence, you're perfectly able to go vote, and I hope you do.
Willie, so thanks.
Kind of my comment.
Thanks for sharing your story. John Eason, felons are allowed to vote in Wisconsin, provided they're not on probation or parole. How common is that across the United States?
It is more common than you'd think, but there are certain states that are very prohibitive, and even years after you've gotten off of probation, you're still subject to a board to approve whether or not you can vote. Wisconsin is actually more restrictive than states, than neighboring states, and allowing people to get back onto the voter rolls, more restrictive than Illinois, Michigan, and Iowa. But Wisconsin overall fares pretty well. But back to that racial disproportionality, nationally, you know, once you get out of prison, your parole sentence, everything tends to be longer for African Americans. So that would, I think, infringe on people's ability to vote.
Willie, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Lee, who joins us from La Crescent, Minnesota. Lee, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
I feel if a felon can't vote, then they shouldn't have to pay taxes then, because then effectively they don't really have any representation. So I think there's kind of a constitutional, fine line that it kind of skates on right now.
All right, Lee, thanks thanks for the question. Not everyone agrees with Lee. We have an email says, when people go to prison, a lot of things that used to be rights become privileges, the ability to go wherever you want, to contact whoever you want, whenever you want, to structure your own day, to have a job. Why should voting be any different? So a couple of different views on who should be able to vote and who shouldn't. What's the is there settled case law on how you can lose the right to vote for your entire life?
No, there isn't. I actually that's the first Lee bringing up the taxation without representation, I think, is a rather radical idea. In other countries, you know, in Italy, for example, depending on the type of crime you're convicted of, you can still work. So, and many European countries allow you to vote while you're in prison. So, we're kind of draconian in a way. We like with medicine, we see medicine, you know, access to medical care is a privilege here. There are things that other developed countries see as rights, and we have turned them into privileges, which is interesting in its own right.
But isn't voting a right given under the Constitution?
It is.
Okay. So I guess I'm surprised that there haven't been court challenges that have gotten to the Supreme Court to decide this issue.
Not that I know of. I have not seen any that have gone that far, as far in terms of you know, people challenging their right to vote. I think these things have been left for states to decide, and that's part of the issue, where you have massive abuses at the state level and no real recourse for individuals to get there to become full members of society.
We're talking with John Eason, an associate professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, about how people in prison are counted on the census and how that affects our democracy, and also who gets to vote and who doesn't get to vote. I noted on a map that shows what the law is in each state that there were two states in the United States where everybody votes no matter what. I believe it was Vermont and Maine. They were kind of the outliers, and then you have other states that are very restrictive. Has the census always counted people in prison the way we've been describing so far?
For at least the last 50 years, according to my studies of this topic. So it's been quite a while. There are states that have exceptions to it. New York, I know that Louisiana, which is leads the world in rate of incarceration, because prisoners were throwing off their schooling, I believe, their apportionments for schooling, they decided to count prisoners in a different way in the last 20 years, I believe. But there are very few states that go against that.
Do we know what portion of the United States electorate is unable to vote because they're in prison?
More than 5 million people.
And is voting restricted for everybody who's in prison, or is it just people who are in prison for felonies?
Oh, you mean overall? So there are 2.3, there are over 2 million people in prison at any given point in time, right? About 2.2 million. Mm-hmm. So those people, I mean, Vermont and Maine don't incarcerate a lot of people, right? Every year there are 2 million plus people in prison who cannot vote. They're in prison and or jail, and they typically cannot vote in prison and or jail. So that's taking people out of the labor force, but also out of our pool of potential voters.
We've got less than a minute left here, John Eason. The census is coming up again in 2020. What's being done to change the way prisoners are counted in the census?
Well, that's partly why I'm appearing on this show. I think there are a number of people who are advocating for prisoners to be counted in their last address. There are organizations like the prison policy initiative that I mentioned earlier. They're doing great advocacy around this. I think this is a real issue where we may need to not only allow people to vote once they get out, but I think this is something we need to visit in terms of letting people vote even when they're in prison, if we're going to be a real democracy.
John Eason, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me, John.
John Eason is Associate Professor of Sociology at the UW-Madison and author of Big House on the Prairie, The Rise of Rural Ghetto and Prison Proliferation. Coming up next, paying attention to the news can help give you an idea of who you'd like to vote for, but have you looked up how competitive your district is, tracked how much money the candidates are attracting and where it's coming from and how it's being spent? Taking a look at voting records. We take a look at how to do some last-minute fact-checking before Election Day. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Tomorrow is voting day all across America, and by now you've seen a Googleplex of political advertising and almost as much horse race news coverage. But are you prepared to vote? What questions do you still have about the candidates? What would you like to know? We're here to help. How have you prepared for the election? What kind of research have you done on the candidates and on your district? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Derek Willis is a news applications developer at ProPublica, focusing on politics and elections. He's also a co-founder of Open Elections, a project to collect and publish election results from all 50 states. Derek, welcome to the morning show.
Glad to be with you, John.
The first piece of advice that you have for voters is to figure out how competitive your district is. Why is that an important thing for voters to know?
Well, I think it's important for a couple of reasons. The first is mainly so that it gives you a basis for understanding the volume of advertising that you're seeing or not seeing, depending on how competitive your district really is. So if you're seeing and hearing advertisements all the time, it's a good sign that your district is pretty competitive or that someone's trying to make it competitive. And I think it helps you frame sort of this race that's going on in terms of how much attention it really deserves compared to some of the other races on your ballot. Because a lot of times there are, in states like Wisconsin and plenty of other states, there are a number of races on the ballot. Not all of them are competitive. The competitive ones tend to get a lot of attention from the political professionals, and they should get some attention, maybe a little more attention, from voters as well.
And how do you figure out how competitive your district is?
So luckily, there are people who help with that. Obviously, the candidates and the parties, they know roughly how competitive a district or a race might be. But there are folks all around the nation who watch these sort of races, whether it's at the state level or at the national level, and who actually rate them. And so we, for example, at ProPublica, we use the Cook Political Reports ratings for House and Senate races. And these are folks who spend time talking to candidates, talking to people on the ground in those areas, trying to get a sense of what that district or that race is like and how competitive it will be. And so for almost every race you have, there are people out there whose job it is to sort of gauge the competitiveness of it.
And how does the Cook Report figure out how competitive a race is?
So there are a lot of different metrics that they use. One of, like I said, is simply talking to the candidates. And obviously, if you're able to get a hold of a campaign and talk to them and they have an actual presence, that's a sign that they're taking things pretty seriously. But there are other factors as well. One of those is money in fundraising. So a campaign might be raising money, and that's a fairly good sign that they are organized and trying to make the race competitive. Or if money is coming in from outside into that district or into that state, that's also a sign that other people think, hey, there's a race going on here. Beyond that, endorsements and obviously just news coverage can also help sort of define the competitiveness.
Well, let's talk about money since you mentioned it. There's so much money involved in campaigns, and it can be really intimidating to try to figure out where it's all coming from and how it's being spent. How can voters go about doing this?
So there are a couple different tools that both we at ProPublica have and that other organizations have built to help with this problem. Because, as you say, it really is, it can be kind of overwhelming. I track political money, you know, for my job, and it sometimes feels overwhelming just to me, and it's what I do. One of the ways is we have this a website called Election Data Bot that ProPublica we have built. And what it does is it kind of tracks how much money and shows you when money comes into a race, whether it's being spent on behalf of a candidate or against a candidate, and who's doing the spending. And then if you want, you could, from there, just take a look at the donors to that particular organization to see if those are folks that, you know, names that you recognize, or whether they're local or national, or whether they're, you know, party aligned or not, or not aligned with a party. And so following the money is, it's a little complicated, and definitely there's a lot of information out there, but there are tools to do just that. And it helps, I think, people understand why a race might be important when you see the different kinds of groups that are spending their time and effort trying to influence voters in that district.
Derek Willis is a news applications developer at ProPublica, focusing on politics and elections. We're helping you get ready to go vote, some last-minute fact-checking, and ways for you to do a little bit more research on the people that you'll be voting for tomorrow. So, Derek, what are things you should pay attention to when you're looking up where a candidate got their campaign dollars?
So there's a couple things I would suggest. One is there's a sort of a dividing line between institutional support, so from businesses and political action committees that represent an interest or an organization, and then there's also individual support. And one of the things we've seen this year in these midterm elections is that there's a lot of interest from the grassroots, both on the left and on the right, and that has that translates itself into money. Small donations, people giving $5 or $10, whether that's through Act Blue, which is an online fundraising platform for Democrats, or, you know, whether that's when the president comes to your state and does a fundraising event or does a rally. This measuring or evaluating the amount of money and the types of money that come from organized interest versus grassroots interest, I think, is one way of kind of not only gauging how competitive a race is, but what voters' enthusiasm is for a particular candidate.
And how do you tell when the amount of money being spent by a candidate isn't typical, when there's more than the usual amount? How do you know that?
So one, if they've run before, a great way is to look at a previous campaign to say, hey, is this more than they spent last time? But also, even just to look at other races of that for that same office. So if you're in Wisconsin and you're looking at and you're trying to gauge that for the first district, or, you know, or for the eighth district, which are both, you know, varying competitive races, you know, you can look and see, hey, in the eighth district last time, you know, not a lot of money was spent, although it was relatively competitive, but compared to this year, the money is way up this year and in that district. And that's a really good sign that this is an actual race and that the both sides really care about the outcome and are really pouring in resources to try and make that happen for them.
Another useful metric that you look at or to look at is the funding gap between candidates. What can that tell us?
So that can, first of all, tell you if there's really not much of a race going on at all. If one candidate has significantly outraised the other, that might be a pretty good sign that the race isn't very competitive. That's not always the case. There are certainly examples of candidates who are not well-funded who have gone on to win or to upset well-funded challengers. The rule really is that money doesn't necessarily determine the outcome, but it's pretty correlated with winning. Generally speaking, people who win tend to have enough resources to win. That doesn't always mean that the person with the most money wins, though.
What about outside spending? I mean, we've talked about what the candidates spend and what the and where they get their money, but how do we have a way to measure where the outside money is coming from and who it's supporting?
Yeah, at the federal level, the Federal Election Commission publishes this information, and we include that at ProPublica in our election data bot to tell you who is spending and how much money is coming into a race. At the state level authorities also will tend to keep track of that. One of the interesting things that folks can do, actually, is they can look online to see via the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission site, they can look online to see who is buying advertising television stations and across the state or across the nation. And so we've got multiple ways of looking at that information. And one of the things really to look for is folks coming in whom you may not recognize, whose names are, you know, not familiar to you, versus those who, you know, are established players either in the state or at the national level, or organizations that have an identity that you can recognize. If you don't see those, if you see folks you don't recognize, that's, again, a pretty good sign that there's interest in this that goes beyond sort of the typical regular year-in, year-out political interest.
Something else to consider is where candidates stand on issues you care about and their records on those issues, but that can also be a little tricky to sort through. What are some resources that you'd recommend?
So it is tricky because this is one of the things where candidates have the most control over what you hear or don't hear about their records or about their stances. So obviously the campaigns themselves are one way, and that's, you know, whether that's through the website or whether that's going out to a rally or a town hall or a meeting where a candidate or representative of the campaign is speaking. They issue statements, and one of the things that we do at ProPublica is we kind of look at what they say and what they talk about as a proxy for what's important to them. And so we do this for incumbent members of Congress, and we have just started doing this for candidates as well. And so you could use that as sort of like guideposts for the things that are important to those campaigns, and for other. For other candidates and other races, sometimes the League of Women Voters and other organizations that are more civically oriented will help, you know, kind of round out the image of what these candidates are talking about and what are important to them. And sometimes I would say like the job itself, you know, if they're running for a, you know, if it's a agriculture commissioner job somewhere, you know, if they're not talking about farming, then, you know, that's a good sign that's, you know, like maybe that's not the job for them.
Should people who tend to just vote along party lines consider these things?
Yeah, I think so, because although, look, political polarization is clearly a really powerful force in our time, but it's not necessarily going away, whether one election or two elections down the road. It is something you should consider because candidates will, you know, they try to fit the electorate where they meet the electorate where they are. And so sometimes that means a Republican says things that maybe other Republicans in other parts of the country may not say, and vice versa for Democrats. And so it's something that voters should keep an open mind to.
It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Derek Willis is a news applications developer at ProPublica, focusing on politics and elections. Also co-founder of Open Elections, a project to collect and publish election results from all 50 states. Derek, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me, John. My pleasure.
This reminder, tune in tomorrow night at 7 for live election coverage from NPR and WPR. We'll be here through the night with live updates of election returns and analysis on national and state races. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. There's a shortage of teachers in the American Indian community. That's why the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee recently received $1.1 million from the United States Department of Education's Bureau of Indian Education to address the issue. Why is there a shortage? Well, that's one of the questions we'll try to answer this morning. We'll also talk about the program's aims and what might be accomplished. Margaret Newton is director of the Electa Quinney Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She's also an associate professor of English at the university. Margaret, welcome to The Morning Show.
Good morning.
First of all, tell us, what is the Electa Quinney Teacher Training and Administrative Leadership Program?
It's a very long term, but it's basically just to support Native teachers in pursuing a career in education. Some of them choose to become certified and teach at an elementary level. Others go for middle school or high school. We actually even support people as they pursue administrative and superintendent licenses.
The United States Department of Education's Bureau of Indian Education recently awarded the program $1.1 million. What purpose will that money serve?
We actually are going to be focusing this time on how we can encourage people to pursue a career teaching math and science. That's something that we know we have a shortage of all over the state, especially in the Milwaukee area and some of the communities near some of the reservations. So there have been grants awarded in the past that supported people going into the early childhood area, so we've made a little progress there, and now we're going to see if we can focus on some of the other areas.
And what schools, where will these students be teaching when they're done?
They can actually teach in a wide range of schools. There are a number of schools here in the Milwaukee area that have a high population of Native students, and there are a number of public schools that are near the tribes. We have reservations throughout our state, and those nations often send their kids to public schools right near their home.
And why is it important that the children at these schools are taught by American Indian teachers?
I think it really is the way many people feel. If you go to school and you see a diverse group of teachers, you see a diverse group of leaders in that school encouraging you to do your best, and in that group you can see yourself, you have a better chance for success. So when you sit in a classroom, if people recognize your Native identity and you can recognize in some of the people who are helping you the same Native identity, I think it really does ensure a better success.
This project is intended to address the teacher and administrator shortage in the American Indian community. Let's talk about what the scope is of that shortage. How big a problem is this?
It is actually a pretty big problem. We have a history in this nation of having Native communities not necessarily trust public education or higher education, because initially there was a lot of people sent to schools that weren't their choosing. They were in situations where they were discouraged from speaking their language, and it took a while for people to trust going to schools and sending their kids to schools. So it definitely, the next step was it took a while to believe that a career in that field would be good. So we just are behind several decades, really, generations that we need to make up if we want to make sure that students have Native teachers.
Why is the focus of this particular project on those who want to teach science, technology, engineering, math, and computer science?
It really is, I think, for us, one of the last areas that we have very, very low representation. I think that we have all across the country people focus on what they call the STEM areas for students. We know that it's an important thing for them to do well in a variety of careers, and so there is an initiative across the country to have kids here in America do better in those areas. And we just want to make sure that we have Native teachers be a part of that movement, and that the Native kids are seeing in that area the same representation that other kids might be seeing.
This is the second year that the program has received money from the Department of Education. What was the money used for last year?
Most of the money that we get goes directly to students. So these are students who fill out the same financial aid materials that everyone fills out when they go to college, and it's partly based on need. I mean, certainly if there are other scholarships that they could use first, we encourage them to do that so that we can reach the widest number of students. But for many of them, they do not have extensive funding. They don't come from a community that's giving them full-ride tuition support, and so this is really to help them pay their tuition and buy books and do those things you have to do when you're in college.
I want to circle back and talk a little bit more about the history and kind of how we got to the point where we've recognized there's a shortage and we're actually trying to do something about it, because probably there are a lot of people who aren't necessarily aware of why it was that there was so much mistrust of the public school system because of the things that had happened historically. Could you just maybe expand on that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, it's a really actually hard subject to talk about here in Wisconsin. One of the things I often say first is that the citizens of Wisconsin were very supportive of Native people, and when some of the Native leaders were working out how reservations would be formed and go forward, many of the citizens of Wisconsin, when it first became a state, were very supportive. But there were other areas where the education was controlled either by the government or by missionary groups, and their goal was to remove the traces of culture and language and really completely assimilate children. And it had some pretty profoundly negative effects in some cases. There were always a few cases where kids went to these schools and they did okay and they learned what they needed to, But for instance, in Canada, they had an entire truth and reconciliation movement where they addressed what actually happened in some of the schools. And in many cases, there were things going on that no adult would want happening to kids in a school setting, and kids were separated from families, and they really were traumatized in a way that moved forward several generations. If you don't grow up with good parenting, you often struggle to provide that yourself, and then it gets perpetuated. So people saw the schools as part of this system, and they really hesitated to get engaged further with a system that really many people would say is the reason that the languages are endangered now.
Mm-hmm. Where do your students come from?
My students, if you're talking about me personally, I teach Ojibwe at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, which is a wonderful, wonderful job. I have an assistant teacher now that teaches it with me, and our first year class has about 15 students, and every year we have about half and half. We have students who say, this is part of my own heritage, I want to learn this language because it's the language my ancestors spoke. But the other half of the class will say things like, I want to learn this language because I'm fourth or fifth generation Wisconsin citizen. I came here to this institution in Milwaukee, and I realize that all around me are words in a native language, and I just want to learn more about that. So we have kids mostly from the state of Wisconsin, and they range from, I think right now I have a group that covers about four different tribal nationalities, and then there's a number of students who are American.
The Electa Quinney Teacher Training and Administrative Leadership Program is a partnership. Could you talk to about what the partnership is intended to accomplish?
It's a partnership with the Electa Quinney Institute and the School of Education on our campus, and then there is a school in Milwaukee, the Indian Community School, that will be celebrating its 50th anniversary next year. And at that school, they have really supported Native education for quite a long time. They teach four languages at the school. To the extent that we have those languages available in our region, they're the languages of the area, and it's a school where in every way that they can, they try to improve education in our Native communities. So really, between this private elementary school, an institute on a university campus, and then the public instruction in Milwaukee and at the state level, we all work together to see how we can make a difference.
$1.1 million. How many prospective teachers will that money support?
Well, our first million that we had supported 15 teachers for all the way through, from the very beginning to getting certified. And then the second, we think that it will support about 10. Part of that is because what we're doing is trying to encourage people to do whatever they can to move to the next level in their career. So sometimes we're asking people to do a little bit of graduate school work or do something more than just the basic. So we really let the students design the program that is right for them and their own career goals. But tuition is not cheap, and we try to spread it as far as we can.
I hear you. Margaret Newton, thank you so much for talking with us this morning.
Miigwech. Thank you.
Margaret Newton is director of the Electa Quinney Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and an associate professor of English at the university. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.